John G. Baker, Monroe County presiding. The Honorable Michael P. Barnes of St. Joseph County and the Honorable Terry A. Crone of St. Joseph County. You may be seated.
This cause is entitled the State of Richmond State Hospital against Paula Brayton, an appeal from the Superior Court of Marion County. For the appellants, the court is informed that the Attorney General's office will be heard by via Mr. Steiner. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you reserve 10 minutes, I understand. And the appellees are represented in today by, amongst others, Mr. Shackelford and Mr. Kautzman, both of whom will be heard. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you'll decide on how you divide up your time so that we don't have to referee that. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Very good. Mr. Steiner, you may be heard.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I apologize to the audience that we didn't have an opportunity to move this to some bigger venue, but we didn't know that we were going to have so many visitors, but we welcome all of you here to our little courtroom. Small room, a lot of justice, though. So.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case is really about events that occurred way back in 1953 and in 1967 to some extent. As the court knows, the legislature in 53 established office hours for state offices of 8.5 hours with a 1 hour unpaid lunch for employees working those offices. That was minimum hours. In 1967, rules were promulgated that set the minimum work week for state employees not working in state offices at 40 hours per week. So that sets the stage not long ago. More than 20 years later, a controversy developed in 1988 when the state learned that some state institutions were allowing their employees to work less than 40 hours a week when it was in a situation other than a state office. That was mostly state hospitals, some state institutions of that nature. At that point, the state personnel department instructed state institutions to begin scheduling their employees for 40 hours per week. Some correctional facilities did not come into compliance actually until 1990. A number of state merit employees filed administrative grievances, exhausted their administrative remedies, and took the matter on judicial review. The merit employees based their claim on a personnel rule relating only to merit employees, requiring the state pay plan to be based on certain principles, including equal pay for comparable work in several agencies of the state. This action resulted in this court's decision in Arden in 1991, which determined that some of the merit employees who were non-exempt under overtime laws had a viable claim. After Arden, as explained by Keith Beasley of the Personnel Department in lengthy deposition testimony, the state settled a number of grievances based on the guidelines outlined in the Arden decision. And in September of 1993, the work hours of employees who did not work in state offices were changed to a minimum of 37.5 hours per week. So that sets the parameters for this case. In 1993, when this case was filed, this case only involved plaintiffs in the merit service. The non-merit employees were not added to this case until 2002. And then, over the strong objection of the state that the claims of the non-merit employees could not possibly be based on a personnel rule that did not apply to them. But that seemed to be the gist of their case in this particular situation. In any event, there are two groups to look at. So I'm going to look first at exhaustion of administrative remedies regarding the merit employees.
If we assume that the trial court was correct in the ruling on the exhaustion issue, isn't Arden dispositive of the claim of the merit employees?
Well, Arden certainly is offers guidance on that issue. And in fact, the state took affirmative action, as I indicated, in September of 93, making everyone that was outside of the state offices into a 37.5 hour minimum work week. So we're really not, we don't have to re-decide Arden here.
So the answer would be basically yes, subject to
yes, it would.
Quibbling over the amount but
Yes.
The validity of the claim itself.
Well, and of course, the amount's a big issue in this case, too, that 10
I don't
day,
mean to quibble it as a minor matter, but the validity of the claim would be dispositive,
absolutely.
Right?
Okay. We certainly understand.
Just so I can keep up with you, because you've got so many things to do and you got so little time to do it. The merit, you're concerned about the merit employees.
Merit and the non-merit, treating them separately. First, the merit employees. So the merit employees are really the ones that are involved with the exhaustion issue.
I was going to ask you a question, but
sorry.
Before you corrected me. As to the merit employees, if the one issue you have referenced, other than the amounts, the one issue you have referenced them is exhaustion, right?
Right.
Okay. Let's just jump ahead. What would we have learned if we'd have gone through exhaustion of administrative remedies that we did not know then being 1993?
Well, for one thing, we would have been able to actually make a record in this case that would have explained whether someone was in a split classification or not. In this particular, the way we did it in this case, we don't really have a good result in that way, because the only document that was really relied on was not even a document that was created in the regular course of business. It was this Exhibit C. And the Exhibit C was just a document that was ad hoc created by personnel to get an idea for union negotiations of what had been going on at a particular day.
Are you telling me that the reason you needed to have administrative hearings in 1993 was because the state didn't keep very good records?
The reason is because that's how you make a record whether someone is in the classification of correctional officer
who
is actually
keeps those
in a
records?
Class or not.
Who keeps those records?
Well, personnel keeps those records, but we were also
State of India.
We were also talking about a time frame as determined by the trial judge between 1973 and 1993.
You're not claiming any privilege.
No.
As to Exhibit C, right?
Oh, no. We're not claiming that it was.
It's a document that was created by the state, right?
Well, we are claiming that we didn't specifically make an argument. It really was a document created probably for purposes of potential litigation.
Regardless of why it was created by the state, right?
It was.
Why wouldn't it be an admission of a party?
Well, because the document, as we pointed out in testimony at the trial, was not accurate. It really doesn't reflect the reality even on a particular day. And we don't even know what particular day Exhibit C was created on, to be honest with you, Your Honor. So we have a lot of problems.
Well, Mr. Stanley, we hope you would be. We hope you would be. Honest, that is.
That's right. Now, there are really three reasons why the merit employees shouldn't recover in this case. Without getting into detail on the damages, or part of it is a damage issue, I guess I should say.
The
first
merit
issue
or the
is exhaustion.
Did you say merit or non-merit?
Merit. I'll talk about merit first. There are three issues. First, there's the exhaustion issue. Then there's this problem that they really don't have, the merit employees don't have a viable claim for contract damages because the state, because it's already been determined in the Americanos case some time ago that there is no private right of action for damages under the State Personnel Act, which is the act which gives rise
to overturn Arden. I thought we just went through this. If you don't win on the exhaustion, don't the merit employees recover pursuant to Arden?
Well, Arden was different. Arden, the parties in that case did exhaust their administrative remedies. They did take
and if
it
you
on
don't have that remedy. Obligation, how is the evaluation of their substantive claim any different?
Well, first we start with Americanos. Americanos says that there is no private right of action, so that's significant. The second thing is the
other than the contract,
the requirement that the employees exhaust their remedies was one of the contract obligations on the employees, just like the right to equal pay for comparable work.
Sir, I thought I read somewhere in the record that one of your own employees said that it would, that had they made a claim, we're talking about merit people now, a contract claim, it would have been denied.
Well, he didn't exactly say that. What he said was something to the effect that no relief was to be had.
We have the record here. So
we do.
We'll just find out. Go ahead.
But if you look, we pointed out in a reply brief, Your Honor, that if you look at the entire question and answer at that point, what he was asked was prior to the Arden decision, what would have happened? And all the
well, it was the finding of the trial court that it was a futile act, right?
It was a determination, yes. But based on
evidence,
what's
our standard of review on that? Use of discretion?
It would be whether there was substantial evidence to support that decision.
And you're saying that you don't think that is?
No, because in fact, the evidence, if you look at all the evidence, and particularly what Mr. Beasley said in that deposition, he first made it clear that there had been a decision regarding the claimants, the grievance in the Arden case. That was up on appeal. What he was asked about many years later was, well, while Arden was pending, what would the decisions likely have been, of course, in those cases?
Well, didn't he say that all of them were denied?
He did not say all
might have been.
He did not say that any were denied, actually. What he was asked a subjective question.
Prior to the Arden decision, there was no relief to be had over the differences in hours of work?
That's what he said, but you have to remember that what he was asked about was really a subjective question. What would the decision have been in one of these cases
before
prior
Arden's
to the decision in Arden?
Well, all 150 of the Arden plaintiffs were denied, right?
Well, I don't remember whether there was 150 in Arden. I think there was less than 150, but there was a sizable group in Arden.
But they were all denied.
They were originally denied. There was a decision. Basically, what we have is we have a decision by personnel and then a hearing in front of the State Employee Appeals Commission, as we would expect, and a decision by SEAC.
What's the difference between futility and foolishness?
There is a difference because the Indiana Supreme Court, of course, in Celebration Fireworks, and this court in cases like Johnson versus Patriotic Fireworks and many other cases, has pointed out that it's very important that even if the agency might make a decision denying your particular grievance, that you go through the process so that we can create the record that actually permits a appropriate review. That is, we know what all the facts really are about that particular claim. And in this case, we had many classifications, not just one represented by each class member, but we had correctional officers and psych attendants and people that were working clerical positions. We had many, many, many different positions, some of which may have been split, some of which may not have been split, some of which may have had people that were working 35 hours a week prior to 1988.
So what you want us to do is to order that these people be required to go through it, something that even you would acknowledge would have been ruled differently?
Well, no, it would have. That's not true, I would argue, Your Honor, because had they gone through the process.
You have sat down with all these people and said, we're going to come up with an arrangement. We're willing to look at each one of you individually.
Each one of those individuals had the right to pursue.
I'm sorry, sir, you didn't hear my question. Have you approached each one of the plaintiffs and said that we will work out and figure out whether you're split or what, or we, and then we'll compensate you? I don't think so.
I don't know that the record says that, but here's what I do know the record
says.
It
sure doesn't, doesn't it?
For people who did file grievances,
uh-huh,
they did work out those details with them. And some of them actually had claims settled between the time that Arden was decided and before the lawsuit was filed in this case. So that in fact did occur. So it's not a situation where it was entirely futile. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't futile for another reason.
Well, it was futile at least up until the Arden decision was issued, right? Or there was a sufficient record for the trial court to make that finding.
By the time the trial judge made his decision, it was long after Arden and long after the
state. But until Arden's was decided, everybody struck out, right? I mean, no one who made an appeal on this basis that we're here today about was successful until Arden's was decided. No? Yes or no?
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, what the record doesn't show was how many of those individuals we're actually talking about that filed the grievance and actually pursued it. And I think that's significant. Every person who had a potential claim that was similar to the claim that was successful in Arden could have easily filed a grievance. You just, you know, file a form. And as the courts had indicated later on, when we look at the State versus Bishop case, Siak versus Bishop, Siak versus Green later on in the Supreme Court case, they said that the 10-day back rule applies to the merit employees. That is, for people who file grievances, they have a right to make a claim 10 days back from when they filed their grievance or to get back paid during that period of time. And so it was important.
What's the purpose of the 10-day requirement?
The 10-day requirement really relates to the fact that the claim was being made at that point in time and that you had a right to, you needed to file your grievance within
Green and Bishop say that's to protect the state, right?
That's, well, certainly.
To put the state on notice.
To put the state on notice and also to protect the state in terms of accumulating unwarranted amounts of liability in a situation that could easily be rectified.
Was it the state on notice that they had an improper policy upon the receipt of the ruling in Arden?
Was it, the state did make changes based on Arden.
Right.
And relatively promptly.
They were put on notice at least as of the hand down of Arden, right?
That's correct.
Your point is that you only can fix those things that you know are broke. And those people who had gone through the administrative process, you knew they alleged brokenness.
Right, and the people who had filed a claim and brought it, you know, had it there in front of the state after Arden and before this lawsuit were filed were, in some cases, given relief by without having even go to judicial review or onto the Court of Appeals.
Have any idea about the numbers there, Mr. Steiner?
I do not. Give us a good number of exactly how many people have.
I didn't see filed. It. I didn't know whether or not I missed it. That's all I'm
well,
asking.
And that's something that I look for coming into this case at the appeal level, and there's just no good number there. There were some people. Exactly how many, I do not know.
Okay, talk about the other people, the non-merit.
The non-merit employees should not succeed in this case because, let's start with this. If we look closely at the trial judge's decision in this case, he bases his decision on the equal pay for comparable work rule. But we know, and in fact it's conceded by the plaintiffs in this case, that the equal pay for comparable work rule only applied to the merit employees.
Well, where's the trial court set out the theory for recovery for the non-merit employees?
Well, that's a good question, but I think it's in, let me find it very quickly here.
I thought one of the things you complained about was that he didn't set out a specific.
Well, theory. He did not. What he said, and I think it was in, I'm just looking, searching right now for it. It was his finding, and I'm just not finding it right now, but I think it might have been 55. No, wait a minute. It was.
You turn around, she'll tell you.
Now I have it here, but I don't. If you want to just take a second, but I can give you that information.
There was more than one theory proffered for their recovery.
There's
right?
There's three findings in a row, and I'm just not finding that number right here in front of me while you dig it out. But there were three findings in a row. The first finding was that the merit employees had a right to recover under the equal pay for comparable work rule. Then there was a finding that related to that, and then there was a third finding that said that employees were entitled to compensation under this rule that were like them or similarly situated. Well, we would contend, excuse me, that the non-merit employees are not similarly situated to the merit employees, because if we are talking about a contract theory, as we are in this case, the contract is informed by the rules, the statute's rules that apply to that employee. No rule that related to.
So non-merit employees are not contractually, don't have a contract with the state with regard to their employment?
Not with regard to equal pay for comparable work. That was
so a non-merit employee who is whatever task we might doing it at place X, doing and over here at place Y, same work, same non-merit employee.
Right.
He or she is working 40 hours a week. This person's working 37.5 a week. Tough tomatoes.
That's what, that, there is no rule that prevented that. There was a
Doesn't
functional,
Arden suggest that would be the case?
Arden is based entirely on the equal work for equal pay for
comparable work. But doesn't Arden suggest that if merit overtime exempt employees had counterparts working 37.5 hours a week, that the court would have gone on to discuss equal pay for them also?
Arden did not.
It's not at issue because of a failure of proof.
Well, Arden just didn't involve non-merit employees. That whole type of claim didn't arise in this whole situation until 2002.
When they were added over the state's objection.
That's right. So the fact is they just do not fit into that. They don't have that contract provision.
Is there any other reason to exclude the non-merits who were joined in 2002 other than that?
Well, yes. The trial court did not buy into this, but the plaintiff's claim on appeal and claimed in the trial court, so we addressed it in our brief initially, that Article 1, Section 21, just compensation, and Article 1, Section 23, relating to equal privileges and immunities, was somehow part of an employment contract that they had with the state of Indiana. No state, no court in the state of Indiana, including Judge Handley, by the way, at the trial court level, has ever decided that there is a private right of action under Article 1, Section 21, or Article 1, Section 23. And in fact, in the Cantrell case and in other cases, the Supreme Court has indicated that there is great doubt whether you have a private right or
didn't say no,
under
though,
the
did
Indiana
it?
Constitution.
Didn't say no.
No, they
in
didn't
that
say
dicta.
No.
Didn't,
but we start with the fact that Judge Handley did not even address, decide it on this basis.
And of course, if Judge Handley was right, you wouldn't be here, would you, according to you? You wouldn't be the appellant here, right? So is Judge Handley really the person that you want to
cite? We're just not pointing out. Yes, we've attacked his decision. There's no question about it. And so I'm not hanging my hat on everything that he has to say. But the fact is, no court has made that. So, yes, for that basis, on that reason, there would be no basis for giving liability in favor of these non-merits. And this is a very big issue. When we look at the winery case, I just want to point that out maybe before I sit down and save some time. The winery case was a case based on a statute, not on the Indiana Constitution. In the winery case, there were non-merit employees involved, but there was a very specific statute granting some rights to compensation to some non-merit employees, very specific in nature. And so based on that, there was found to be a private right of action, and they were able to pursue that claim and got injunctive relief, not damages,
The Bay case was a constitutional case, though, right?
That's correct, but that was an article that we're talking about. There's been no compulsion here,
But that's a recognition of a right to recover under
constitutional. Well, it talked about, in Bay, they did not say you could have a private right of action. They didn't reach that decision. They avoided it there. They avoided it in Cantrell.
They said some form of payment of money was assumed to be recoverable if they had performed particular services, right?
But then in Bay, they decided that they weren't entitled to any relief whatsoever. So that was the actual holding in the case, bottom line.
Sir, I want to protect your 9 minutes that you have left.
Okay, thank you.
Remind me, Mr. Steiner, to ask you about winery when you get back up, will you?
Say that again.
Again, remind me that. Yeah, will
you? Mr. Shackelford, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'll be addressing the arguments that have mostly to do with the merit subclasses of employees, and my colleague, Mr. Kaltzman, will be addressing the non-merit subclasses. I'd like to start with this private right of action issue that the state was discussing just now at the podium. The private right of action argument that the state has made is a complete red herring in this case. The plaintiffs are not arguing that they have a private right of action that somehow grows out of either the state regulations or the state constitution.
Making a contract claim.
Yes, Your Honor. Precisely.
And you're saying that all these statutes and administrative provisions are part of the contract for the merit employees.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're saying the non-merit employees don't have a written contract, but the constitutional provisions are implicitly part of their employment contract. Is that right?
Exactly, Your Honor. And there is a case directly on point, the Bernhardt case that this court decided. And I won't quote extensively from it, but in Bernhardt, this court held that the petitioner in Bernhardt, the claimant, had raised constitutional claims. And this court held, quote, any duties between Bernhardt and the state arose out of the employer-employee contractual relationship. The claim may involve constitutional rights, but the action arises from the employment relationship and sounds in contract, not tort. So, Your Honor, we're not up here asking for this court to create some new constitutional right out of either of the two Indiana Constitution provisions that we cite. We're simply seeking to enforce the same contractual rights.
Mr. Katzman's going to talk about what the contract says, right?
Yes, sir. Okay. Your Honor, Judge Baker.
Did Bernhardt Court decide whether a breach of contract action exists for the state's violation of the Indiana Constitution?
In that case, the Bernhardt Court did, in the quotation that I quoted from, the Bernhardt Court did say that the constitutional claim that the petitioner in that case brought was a contract claim. So I believe that is equivalent to a holding that you can make a breach of contract claim as a state employee that invokes a constitutional right that somehow that has something to do with your employment relationship.
Well, what they said was they violated her constitutional right of free speech, and that you couldn't do that in order to, if you were doing that, it would be a violation of the employment contract, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're saying that that somehow means that all of the constitutional provisions are part of an employment contract?
Not everyone.
And provide separate remedies?
Not necessarily. Not everyone, Your Honor. Only ones that have to do with the employer-employee relationship. So, for instance, the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause, in our case, directly concerns whether or not folks who are working 40 hours in one part of the state have a right to be paid the same hourly wage as folks working 37 and a half hours in another part of the state. It has to do with that part of the employment relationship.
Or wouldn't you have to do a Collins analysis?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's what my colleague, Mr. Kaltzman, plans to address in his time. Your Honor, Judge Baker, you asked the question of the state, what would we have learned if we had gone through exhaustion back in 1991, I think the time frame was, that we did not know then? And the state answered that we would have created a record that would have been better than Exhibit C. But that is simply not true, and the record in this case does not support that that is what would have happened. The record in this case that was before the court below.
Well, it is the case that I don't want to stand in for Mr. Steiner, but he's saying that if I had all of these individual claims, I would know who all of these people are, and therefore you wouldn't be able to rely on C, because we'd see the invalidity of Exhibit C. I think that's what he's saying.
My understanding and
because we'd know what Baker's claim was, what Bradford's claim was, what Bailey's claim was, each individual person.
And I would, Your Honor, if that were the case, and if you could have gone through administrative proceedings for all 12,000 class members back in 1987, they would never have gotten information from these people, because for the 150 people who went through the process, all they ruled was that they had no right to equal pay for comparable work. They didn't get into any sort of fact-finding as to whether their class was or was not split, or in what times it was or was not split. So it would have been, quote, of no value under the circumstances to do that back then.
Yeah. Why do you get to go back longer than the 10 days?
Yeah.
The 10-day provision is a provision that applies to administrative grievances. The state is basically trying to take a provision that applies to how much time you have to send a letter to your boss, basically, complaining about some, you know, on the job.
Or how many bathroom breaks you get, or who has to.
That's not what the Green and Bishop says.
No, I'm not speaking about subject matter, Your Honor. I apologize if I seem like that. But it's the procedure is much simpler to file a grievance. You just have to write a letter to someone saying, I am complaining about this aspect of my job. But the process of actually filing a lawsuit, if the grievance procedure is futile, process of filing a lawsuit, you have to find an attorney, you have to interview attorneys. The attorney has to investigate and draw up a complaint and survive a Rule 11 type challenge to make sure he doesn't do something he shouldn't do as an officer of the bar. You then have to file the complaint. In reality, that's not something you can do in a 10-day period, and I'm aware of no statute of limitations for filing a complaint in a court of law in Indiana or in the country.
It's not a statute of limitations, but Green and Bishop both say explicitly that you can only go back 10 days to recover money.
They hold that
from
you
the time the complaint's filed, right?
That if you file an administrative grievance, you can only recover 10 days from the date that you file the grievance. But I have two responses to that, Your Honor. One is, again, you can't port that 10-day period into
Wait a minute. You're porting every single other administrative rule, provision, constitutional provision into this contract. Why doesn't that administrative code provision port into your employment contract?
If filing a grievance was not futile, then that's...
Is it part of your contract, first of all?
To the extent that it, yes, Your Honor, to the extent
it is part of the contract.
To the extent that it governs the employee-employer relationship, it would be part of the contract. But so too would this court's precedents that hold that it can be futile, and you can
That allows your claim to survive. That doesn't go to the amount that you're able to recover. Don't Green and Bishop say the amount you can recover only goes back 10 days?
Green and Bishop say that the amount you can recover goes back 10 days in cases where you file a grievance, 10 days before the date.
It cannot be that where you don't file a grievance because it was futile, you get to recover more than you would if you filed a grievance and were denied.
You're suggesting that somebody who acts on their rights only can go back 10 days, but somebody who sits on their rights can go back 20 years.
No, Your Honor, it was the state's testimony in this case was that it was futile before Arden.
Certainly. I understand.
That's why you have a claim if that position is accepted. That's a separate question than what's the amount of the damage recoverable, isn't it?
I think they're related, Your Honor, because I think that even the Arden claimants, had they instead argued it was futile to resort to administrative remedies and been able to make a record, or even the Bishop claimants, had they been able to make a record.
The Arden people made claims. They filed grievances. So they were going to get back to this day, whatever it was, let's say January 1, 1991, to out here post Arden. That's all they could recover. But they couldn't get anything for 1990 or 1989. They just couldn't. They were limited by their grievance.
There's nothing in Bishop or Green that suggests that it's not a limitation on the amount of recovery, is there?
It's not whether or not you have a claim. It's whether or not how much your claim can be.
How much, yeah.
Bishop says the limitation period limits the damages recoverable by the employees to the time period beginning 10 days prior to the file of their complaints. The Green case says the employees are entitled to back pay only for the time period beginning 10 days before the filing of their complaints.
Of course, in this case, Your Honor, no grievances were filed because it was futile, so I'm not sure how you'd even be able to port that particular limitation.
Let me ask you this question. Is there anything in this record that would indicate the number of grievances that were filed post-Arden's pre-filing of this suit?
Not that I'm aware, Your Honor.
I couldn't find any either. And so it seems to me, though, that after Arden's, it's reasonable to assume that there was a different, we know that the state changed
policy.
Its policy, correct?
Well, the record actually suggests that certainly not an, up until the point this lawsuit was filed, the record suggests the state had not changed this policy.
There. Well, certainly in some instances the state had changed its policy. It got that there still was a 40-37.5 differential, but then at some point went to 37.5. Is that not correct?
It went to 37.5 in, I believe, September of 93, which was a few months after this lawsuit was filed.
Okay.
And the state, I do want to address one issue, one particular statement.
That well, let me finish first,
yes,
and then you're welcome to. The fact is that anyone who would have filed post-Arden regarding this seeming inequity and went through the grievance process or went through a process or had a claim adjusted is necessarily, whether or not they're satisfied or whatever, had some kind of conclusion. It goes back to the question that either Judge Baker or Judge Crone, I think it was both of them in the instance, said, somebody who did that, acted, certainly can't be in a worse position than somebody who did nothing and wants to claim 20 years of back pay. Talk to me about that. How is that possible? That doesn't even make sense.
Well, Your Honor, the record evidence that the state and plaintiffs put into the record here does not support a finding that it would have, that it suddenly became not futile as of 1991 or 92 to file a
grievance. I understand.
Look, you, that horse is dead. Let it go. We'll give you that for the purposes of this discussion. It would have been futile. Now, answer the my colleague's question. Why is it that those who did file a grievance can only go back 10 days, and those that did not can go back 20 years? That does not compute.
Well, if it was, if we are accepting that it was futile at that time,
yes,
then if someone makes a choice, rather than proceeding as the plaintiffs in this case did, if they make a choice to take a route that limits them to 10 days of damages by filing a grievance, they also had the choice to file a lawsuit.
We're not making these rules up. Somebody else made them, and we're not the rule makers. They're downstairs in the legislature. They're the ones that have put this onerous on the workers of the state that they can only go back to 10 days. It's not something that this crew did or any crew that preceded us. So how can it be that the legislative intent is that everybody can only go back 10 days
excuse me,
unless they blow off the requirement for a grievance because it would be futile?
Well, Your Honor,
if that's your position, I'll write it down. I was trying to help you and maybe think that it wasn't you had a different one.
If we accept that it was futile,
yes,
which is granted a narrow exception to the legislature's rule. In cases where it is futile because of the position that the state has taken in not making the administrative machinery properly accessible to the grievance. In those sorts of cases, they are excused, anybody, including someone who nevertheless chooses to file a grievance, they are excused from having to file a grievance, and the 10-day period is out the window because of the actions the state has taken in making the administrative.
So you don't agree that Green and Bishop say that this administrative code provision provides a statute of limitations for the initiation of the claim, and secondly, a limitation on the amount that's recoverable if you have a valid claim. That's what you're saying. You're saying it's all one or nothing. And I think what they're asking is, aren't you talking about two separate issues?
Judge Crone, I do believe it's all one or nothing, because in each case, both.
Why?
Why
would that make sense?
That's the way that if you look at normal statutes.
Purpose of the exhaustion of remedies futility doctrine is to get you into a forum where your grievance can be heard, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't know of any context in which that's ever been used to change the measure of damages on a claim that's being made. Do you?
Well, we cite the one case.
There's a lot of stuff I don't know. There may be, but I'm being sincere. I don't know.
Your Honor, we cited the one case that we could find on this issue where you have competing shorter administrative statutes of limitations versus longer.
D'Alessandro, you're talking
D'Alessandro,
about?
D'Alessandro, yes.
Yeah, I don't think that applies. But there is no purpose in the futility doctrine that's related to the amount of damages recoverable once you go to whether or not somebody has a judiciable claim or not, is there?
Well, the purpose in Bishop and Green, as was stated earlier, was to protect the state so the state would have a chance to address potential problems before they became significant.
They had notice as of Arden.
They had notice before Arden of the scope of this problem. The record reflects that they were thinking about this all the way through the Arden period, and in fact, Exhibit C was created during at some point during this entire process.
And every week, nobody filed a grievance, right?
I'm not sure the
every
record.
Every pay period, none of your folks filed a grievance during any of those pay periods, right?
The record does not reflect one way or the other, Your Honor.
Well, they wouldn't be members of the class if they had. Would
right.
They? They could, in fact, be members of the class if they had filed a grievance.
So?
You could file a grievance, and under the futility doctrine, you're permitted to abandon the grievance and go straight to court and join the class. In fact, it's up for question whether people who filed a grievance and went all the way through, as long as they didn't sign a release, is up for question whether they're also part of the class, because futility excuses everyone from the administrative process. And the 10-day rule is part and parcel of the administrative process. And as a matter of fact, the record reflects that the state even had its chance. It was put on notice in 88 when the first Arden claims was filed, certainly, and continued to stick to its guns, saying that it owed these people nothing. In fact, has stuck to its guns to this day, as you've seen from their appellate briefing, where they still say that Arden was wrongly decided. And they asked for a conclusion of law below that equal pay means equal salaries and not equal hourly wages. So I think the record evidence shows it was futile, and the 10-day period really is.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about that. They did contend that if I'm making $10,000 in work, 40 hours a week, that's the same as if I'm making $10,000 and working 37 and a half hours a week, didn't they? They made that claim.
They made that claim. They asked for a finding or a conclusion of law on that. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Is that for your people or his people?
That's for all of them. Everybody. Asked for all of them.
All right.
Your Honor.
Well, that interesting.
You want to cover a little on Exhibit C?
Yes, Your Honor. I would.
I'm not sure how you guys have got this divided up, but somebody, I want to hear something about
Exhibit C. Well, as I think it was made clear earlier in the argument, there is no dispute that there were split classes of some sort throughout the 20-year class period. The question is a question of damages. And so we went out, plaintiffs went out and tried to get the best available evidence to calculate the damages, to figure out which classes were split and at what time. And I think what you have here with the state is sort of a bait and switch. I mean, there is record evidence, testimony from a state's witness that Exhibit C was the best available evidence of the split classes. It was the evidence the state had been using at one point to figure out split classes. And you also have evidence, testimony from the state's witness, that although Exhibit C only covered one period of time, quote, it's a pretty fair representation, close quote, across a period of time. So plaintiffs relied on that testimony and used Exhibit C, in fact, in exactly the manner as the state had used it. And Mr. Fuller testifies about that on the record at page 914 of the appendix. In addition...
Well, what about Mr. Steiner says, well, look, this is made in preparation to negotiation. You know, probably wasn't accurate. We shouldn't hold us to that.
Wasn't he made it, didn't he?
Accurate to begin with, blah, blah, blah. What do you say to that?
The testimony from trial by...
The record support your point? Is that your point?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The record supports that it was certainly largely reliable. And in fact, the trial judge made very careful findings. He specifically chose that some classes that showed up as split on Exhibit C, he discounted to the tune of about over $7 million for the class and said they're not split. There wasn't enough corroborating evidence. So he went through that exercise of ascertaining how reliable Exhibit C was, and he came up with whatever, 90% reliable, and that is absolutely defensible under a clearly erroneous standard. In terms of Exhibit C's source, there's testimony from Ms. Vigren during the trial that Exhibit C is, quote, the type of information that would have been in our system, close quote. So while Exhibit C itself might have been created for a particular purpose, it was created by drawing information out of the state's own personnel records that they
could. If they had better records, they had an opportunity to go find those better records and to convince the trial court of the inaccuracy of C.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And they did try to do that with some success.
I probably wouldn't say anything more about that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But you can do what you see fit.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make sure that I hit the areas that I promised. The only other issue with the exhaustion of remedies, but this is actually a very critical issue, is the unnamed class members. There is a dispute before Your Honors about who bore the burden of proof to prove failure to exhaust. The state
does
says...
the rule cover that?
The rule does cover that, yes, Your Honor. The burden of proof is squarely on the state.
Rule 8, right?
Yes, Your Honor. So okay. At least...
Okay. We're very reluctant to overrule the Supreme Court who made Rule 8.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I think I'd like to close with a couple of other comments before I sit down. The state in his briefing has tried to frame this case as being about a big payday, but this is a case not about a big payday. It's a case about discrimination and about fairness. The 12,000 employees in this class were paid less, lower hourly wage, despite having the exact same job descriptions as people who worked in state offices. And for just that reason, because of where they happened to work. For the merit employees, Section 242 of the regulations forbade this. And for the non-merit employees, my colleague will discuss how the Constitution forbade this. This case is ultimately about fairness. The state argues that this is about collecting a big check, but that's not right. These state employees, if this court affirms the judgment below, these state employees will get paid the wage they would have been paid if they hadn't been unlawfully discriminated against. There's no windfall here. There's no handout. In fact, it's not even really a fair recovery. These state employees will recover in 1970s and 1980s and 1990s dollars, not with any interest, because prejudgment interest is not run against the state. The state spoke a lot in his briefing about budget problems, but the state should not be permitted to balance the state's budget on the backs of these particular employees who were discriminated against solely because they were working in places like Evansville or South Bend rather than in Indianapolis. That's what this case is ultimately about, Your Honor. And the only other comment that I'd like to address is a question that Your Honor asked about whether all the I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think I will yield the well to my.
You had a question about Exhibit C. Did you want
to? Oh, I believe I answered the questions about Exhibit C.
Yes, we.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
we were very convinced that he did.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Councilman.
May it please the court, 22 years ago when I was a third-year associate with the Ruckelhaus firm, I was assigned my first appellate case. That was what you now know as Arden and Coulter versus SEAC. In fact, it was actually 19 years and 10 days ago to this day that I was in the same courtroom before Judge Baker. We won that appeal, and we have been trying at my firm to try to obtain just compensation for thousands of similarly situated Hoosier workers ever since. Even the trial court noted at findings 94 and 95 that the state is still trying to ride that horse, so to speak. They are still trying to undo Arden. The quote from the trial court finding is, quote, clearly little has changed in the last 18 years, end quote. Now, to address one of the questions that you had about this futility situation and the Bishop and Green situation, for instance, one of our clients who's here today, Mr. Sutcliffe, it was futile for him to try to get relief in the 70s. And in the 80s, and in the early 90s. If somehow, even though this record doesn't establish that, but even if somehow futility became over with at a certain period of time, that doesn't mean he's out of luck completely. At the very least, futility, I don't know of any Indiana cases that talk about futility in a certain time frame, that it somehow is only partially available.
You will acknowledge that the state, not only in this instance here, but in many instances, chooses to treat itself, if I may use the term judgmentally, much more favorably than they would allow you to be to treat your employees.
Mm-hmm.
Equal protection arguments aside, the state can limit a claimant's claim for wages, can it not? I mean, what's with statute of limitations, we call it, or statute of repose or something?
I'm sure it could, as long as it doesn't breach some other principle of law, yes.
So why is the 10-day rule not applicable here? That is, that at the time, given the fact that, let's just for purposes of discussion, it would have been futile for any of these folks to make a claim because even the state's representative acknowledges they would have been denied.
No relief to be had.
Right. But that meant that they would then be entitled to go back 10 days and forward until the state got it right. Correct? I think that's the concern that at least all of us have, is why that limitation isn't there, whether it should be. The General Assembly put it there, not us. But why isn't that as far back as they get to go?
And why doesn't it apply then?
Yes.
I'm hesitant to get back on the same horse Mr. Shackelford was on due to your Honor's comments, but I think they're instructive. Bishop and Green, right in the center of the opinion, specifically says that the 10-day rule, the purpose behind the 10-day rule, is to provide the state an opportunity to cure. And so with all due respect, you can't divorce yourself from the mandates of Bishop and Green and the application of the futility doctrine.
So the futility is not only if you'd have filed it, we'd have denied it, but because we were never going to change our mind until the court made us change our mind.
That's exactly right.
So and therefore 10 days doesn't apply.
Yeah, it becomes apples and oranges. If you were in that process, the 10-day would apply for an administrative process. But if the state stubbornly is futile throughout from here to kingdom come, and the employees are forced to resort to the courts, then that rationale doesn't apply, nor does the application of that principle apply. Now, let me see if I can move quickly, due to time limited, into some of the issues on the non-merit employees. There is ample record evidence, and I don't think my colleague and I can say that many times, too many times. It is the record that controls here, the record of the trial court, because there is a clearly erroneous standard that is at work when the you gentlemen take a look at the findings. The clearly erroneous standard, I don't think, is going to be met because there is ample record evidence that supports the court's conclusion that the defendants breached their employment contracts with the non-merit employees. Now, we have two independent sources that would be engrafted into those breach of contracts. One, the Equal Privileges and Immunities Clause, as it applies to these non-merit people, and two, the Just Compensation Clause. A breach of either one of those, a violation of either one of those provisions, would bring relief through the breach of contract.
And their non-merit contract with the state embodies both those. Is that's your point, right?
That's exactly right. Now, due to time constraints, let me just focus quickly on privileges and immunities.
I'm going to give you 2 extra minutes with my colleague's consent, and then we'll give you 2 minutes. Is that all right, sir?
Fine.
Thank you, Judge. At trial, the plaintiffs introduced sufficient evidence from which the trial court could reasonably conclude without clear error that, number one, the defendants were subjected to disparate treatment, and number two, there was no reasonable basis for that disparate treatment. That's the Collins test. The plaintiffs met both prongs of that. First of all, I don't think it can be seriously argued that there wasn't disparate treatment at work here. By requiring each plaintiff to work 2.5 more hours per week for the same salary as their counterparts, the defendants subjected each plaintiff to disparate treatment. Yet, the defendants apparently still contend that all employees in this classification were treated equally because they were paid the same salary. The same thing Judge Baker pointed out is the frighteningly flawless Orwellian logic that was rejected in Arden continues to attempt to rear its head. Secondly, there was no reasonable basis for that disparate treatment. The practice of requiring that kind of treatment is inherently unreasonable. Indeed, the state recognized that common sense fact by enacting the equal pay for comparable work merit regulation. And furthermore, they recognized it when 2 months after we filed our lawsuit, they moved into the systemic change, realizing that that horse wouldn't fly anymore.
Going back to the 37 and a half.
Exactly, the baseline work week for all employees. So significantly, once again, the record. The defendants offered no evidence at trial from which the court can conclude that there's a reasonable basis for this disparity in pay. Interestingly, in their brief, all they talk about is justifications for the disparity in hours. We got institutions, we got offices, it kind of makes sense to have them different.
Well, they say that, look, we got a salary and, we paid them the same amount of salary even though they were working 10 hours a month more.
I think we do that once before?
We've been through that before.
I mean, was it 17 years ago?
It was 18 years ago, I believe.
But
you're absolutely right. And the state does not even attempt to justify the disparity in pay. They keep talking about hours. Unless there's a reasonable basis for the disparity in pay, they don't meet the prongs of the Collins test. Exactly. Now, even the record shows by the court's own finding number 88, the state system was, quote, casual at best. Finding 59, the policy was not uniformly employed. Finding 90, former personnel director Jennifer Vigran said the system, quote, didn't make sense. These are all candid admissions in the trial court record that I don't think this court will find to be clearly erroneous. Remember, the plaintiffs didn't challenge whether it was reasonable to establish separate hours. The only issue here is if there is a reasonableness of disparately paying a lower effective hourly rate.
So the state could require people to work 40 hours, you just want them to pay them for it.
Exactly, as long as
doing the same work.
Assuming that there's a counterpart doing the same work, they need to be treated equally, and that's what the breach of contract is via the equal privileges and immunities clause. Now, once we get past the source.
It's not a private right of action under the Constitution. It's a breach of the implied contract.
Exactly. The private right of action line of argument by the state is clearly a red herring. This is a simple breach of contract case. The private right of action you'd have to look for if you didn't have it. But my colleague read the Bernhardt case. I could read to you the Terre Haute versus Brighton case, which essentially says
That's the fireman, isn't it?
That's the firefighter case. Once again, a constitutional provision case. Although the firefighter's relationship with the city is involved constitutional rights, the action sounds in contract. Winery, purely contractual. The language goes on in each of those cases. Thus, the clear rule announced in Bernhardt, Brighton, and Winery controls. Where a state employee's claim arises from the employment relationship with the state, whether it's constitutional, statutory, or regulatory, it sounds in contract. Now, in conclusion, I know my time is up.
You have, in fact, another whole minute and 10 seconds. Now, there's no penalty for quitting early.
I will speak slowly and quit early. In fact, based on this trial court record, Your Honors, the trial court was well-grounded in both fact and in law when it ruled in favor of these non-merit employees, and the trial court judgment was in no way clearly erroneous. Therefore, on behalf of myself, Mr. Shackelford, all of our clients, and on behalf of the more than 12,000 Hoosiers that were underpaid every day for the state of Indiana, we respectfully ask this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Regardless of what this court decides, Mr. Kautzman, there are thousands of Indiana former and present employees who have been affected by your efforts because of the state's willingness to change there. So regardless of what you've done, you're entitled to a lot of kudos. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Today's my birthday, so that's the
birthday
present I've had.
Are you now 50?
51.
Well,
it's hard to say on the record, but it's true.
I was just guessing out loud because of the 3 years into it. So you have a few minutes left. I think you now have 11.
That's right.
One thing I'd point out, I was trying to tell you where...
It's not your birthday, is it, Mr.
No, it's not.
he was almost threatening to sing. Please just be assured.
No,
even if it were, you would want to keep it to yourself. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying, even if it is.
I don't know that any of us are talking about birthdays.
All right.
One thing I wanted to point out, I was looking for which conclusion it was that the trial court implied, at least, that its decision was based on the equal pay for comparable work rule, which only applies to the merit employees, and that's conclusion 15. If you look at conclusions 13, 14, and 15, I think that's the closest you can get. Trying to figure out what the trial court decided regarding the non-merit employees, because it stayed away from the constitutional issue, probably intentionally, because I think that's not a good
claim. We can uphold it on any basis, right?
Well,
so if we find that they have a contractual claim pursuant to the constitutional provisions, it doesn't matter if
the trial court was wrong.
That based their holding on the.
That's true. I would say, though, that no court, again, has ever decided that there is a private right of action for damages in this scenario. And that's significant. And let's look at the Winery case.
You don't recognize the distinction between a private right of action and the constitutional provisions being part of the employment contract.
In this particular situation, I don't see how there is any difference. There is no equal pay for comparable work provision in the contract of the non-merit employees. There is nothing that suggests that...
Unless the constitutional provisions are read into the contract.
But even if we would do that, then we'd be looking at, is there, in order for there to be a private right of action, you'd only read in a provision that really provides specifically some benefit to the individuals. For example, in the Winery case, this court discussed the private cause of action doctrine and explained that a state employee may not claim that a statute is part of his employment contract unless the statute imposes a duty for his particular benefit, which is the situation we had in Winery.
You don't think an equal pay provision is for somebody's particular benefit?
Well, Article 1, Section 23 is not an equal pay provision. The equal pay for comparable work provision is not in the statute that relates to the non-merit employees. It's only in the provision.
And purposefully so, you would say, correct?
Exactly. And what we really argue in this case is that as a non-merit employee, you did not have a right to a particular rate of pay. That you
had a right to a salary?
You had a right to be paid what you bargained for.
Which is a salary, and that the state then set the hours, albeit in South Bend, if I'm beating on my typewriter in South Bend at 40 hours, and somebody over there in Evansville or whatever is working 37 and a half hours. We're doing the same thing, same work, same pay, same state, different working conditions, correct?
Well, I don't know that it's really, it is different circumstances. When you're working in a state office,
yeah,
you're dealing
with the person in Evansville is working 2.5 hours
or whatever,
a week.
You're dealing with one functional set of circumstances. If you're out in the field somewhere, you're dealing with a situation where the state may need to have three shifts. It makes sense to divide those three shifts into an eight-hour day. In many cases, we know that...
It precludes you from paying them for all 8 hours.
But we didn't pay anyone for all the hours they work, Your Honor. Remember, we're talking about minimum requirement. We're talking about ghost.
Well, yeah, there you go. I was a state employee too, Mr. Steiner.
Well, I mean, the reality is, let's say you're in South Bend and you're working in a non-state office. You've got a job to do, and it takes you 48 hours that week to do your job. You didn't get, you weren't working on an hourly basis. No one was. Working on an hourly basis. Same thing for the employee in the state office working in Indianapolis. To get their job done 1 week, they work 52 hours.
Is that exactly what Arden said? You can't do that. If they're doing the same work, they get the same pay for the same amount of time.
But it was based on the comparable, equal work, comparable pay rule.
So that only applies to merit employees.
That's right.
And you don't read the Article 1, Section 23, the General Assembly shall not grant to any citizen privileges or immunities upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens to mean the same thing.
It is not a specific provision that in any way directly relates to state employees or non-merit employees.
Well, that's,
it was
isn't
not
that the issue?
Does it
mean that in this circumstance? Isn't that the issue?
Sure it does.
In this circumstance, the question is whether there's a rational basis for having the rules that the state had. The state had these rules in place since 1953.
But the rational basis you're proffering is the number of hours, not the amount of pay.
The rational basis we're proffering is that they're being paid, for the non-merit employees, they're being paid exactly what they were promised they would be paid when they took on that employment. And that it's rational to have different minimum hours in the state offices as opposed to the institutions.
What's the rational basis for paying two people doing the same work two separate rates?
It's based on the function they're performing, whether they're dealing with the public or whether they're working in, say, an institution where
that's not his question, I don't think, is it?
No.
Judge Crone?
No.
What?
And even if it were, I've been in a jail and I've been with the public, and I'm not sure which is harder on any given day. And I'm sure that both of those employees would argue that their working conditions are a little rougher than the other ones. So,
well, we're talking about doing the same thing. Certainly, somebody who's a clerical person or I'm going to say something that's probably an merit thing, but at the South Bend Juvenile Correction Center, or whatever, and then you got the one down in Evansville, and they're doing the same thing. They're talking about Barnes is a bad guy and he escaped and whatever. Down there in Evansville, Steiner's a bad guy and they escaped, whatever. What's the diff? That's my question.
Well, they were being paid on a salary basis. We do have to remember that. They were being paid the same. They were not being unequally compensated. Remember, these were minimum hours. And even though you could say it's 37 and a half.
If I can correct you, they were being unequally compensated. But your point is that was their contract with the state.
That's exactly right. That their contract with the state was what they actually received. They agreed when they came in to state employment, if they were working in the state office, they would be working 37 and a half hours and they'd get this salary.
And my question is, what's the rational basis for such a policy?
Is it
that I should pay as little as I can get away with?
There is a basis for having hours for state employees, a minimum hours for state employees. And we're all concerned about these things like ghost employment. At least the public seems to be.
But why does the minimum hours disparity control the amount of pay per effort or the hourly rate? I understand they get a salary. They're not hourly wage employees, some of them, they're salary employees. But
that's right.
They put in X number of hours and they get Y compensation. If you make a fraction out of it, it's not the same if you're putting in more hours and getting the same Y.
On this record, we do not know that that an employee working in a state office was actually working fewer hours than an employee that was working out in the field somewhere.
Well, we know that the state cut back the requirement from 40 to 37.5 after Arden, right?
And that's true. And that was to
so if we prevent, send it,
oh boy.
But I will say that was to prevent any possibility of accruing future liability in the situation. That's a rational basis for doing that, Your Honor. And that's why that was done in that particular situation. You could do a lot of different things with the positions, but that was one way of handling the situation, which is rational. So that's what they did. I found it interesting when counsel was talking about futility. They were saying, well, it was futile to file in the 70s and the early 80s. Why was it futile to file this claim in the 70s or early 80s? We know that since 1967 that the rule was in place. Now, why didn't they file claims? Could it be that if we looked at the record, we would find that some of these employees were actually only working 35 hours a week, that were supposed to be working 40? We know that was the case. There was evidence of that. There were people that were getting paid lunches at the institutions that wasn't happening at the state offices. This all goes to the issue of the importance of actually having a record in order to make
that,
some
that's really kind of, I got to tell you, Mr. Steiner, that's really kind of offensive to me. Anybody who would be getting a lunch at a state institution and think that that's a perk of some kind, I mean, really, come on.
Well, it's not a, I'm not saying it's a perk to get the lunch. I'm not sure whether they were being provided the lunch or they had time to, you know, bring their own lunch or whatever. The question is, by a paid lunch, I mean, they were not working during some of those hours, those 40 hours a week. They were not working for 5 hours of that 40 hours a week. They were given time off. It was a break. It wasn't work time. That's, in fact, for the state offices, they're working 8.5 hours. They have scheduled 8.5 hours.
As opposed to 8 minus 1, 8.5 minus 1. As
I mean, it's really much more complicated than they made it out to be, and that's why creating a record does have some validity in this kind of situation. It's not really entirely futile.
Why didn't you offer any evidence of that?
We did offer evidence of that, Your Honor.
Maybe I misunderstood. I thought there was no evidence offered at the trial level.
No, there was evidence offered at the trial level about how many hours some people worked, actually. And let's talk about one specific position, the correctional officer's position. This is a position that the trial judge said was worth essentially $9 million in favor of the plaintiffs in this case. There were 30, the only thing that was really pointed to for the correctional officers, and there was very specific evidence on this, the only thing that was pointed to was Exhibit C. Exhibit C on this snapshot, which we don't even know how reliable it was. In fact, we cast some doubt on it, specifically at trial. 3,100 correctional officers working 40 hours a week, according to that snapshot, five working 37.5 hours. We showed at trial that one of those people was clearly just a mistake. That person was working 40 hours a week, and that's in the record. For the others, we cited to the fact that there is a state personnel rule that allows some people to work out of class for a period of time. And so for four people, it may have been that that's what the evidence was. They were working out of class. That was not a split classification. Yet the plaintiffs were awarded $9 million. This is what we're really talking about in terms of being able to look at the record in the case. And that is a determination made by the trial judge that's not supported.
Before you take your chair, if you were to prevail on your 10-day rule but lose on your futility, what would be the number to which Mr. Kautzman's people would be entitled to recover?
I do not know unfortunately, Your Honor, we don't, I don't know that we know that exact number. It would be much less.
Oh, I understand that.
I mean, it would be, we're talking about a period of time, you know, for a year or two rather than 20 years. So you could say that it is on that order of difference.
Thank you.
Thank you. We would ask that the judgment of the trial court be reversed.
I caution counsel, but I think mostly members of the audience and those that are not here in presence, that no one should take anything from the questions that we ask. We do so in order to stimulate our discussion so that when we retire to deliberate this case, we can be better informed. It is always a privilege to have advocates of the quality that we have had here today, both in writing and orally in your presentation. It makes us all proud to be lawyers. Thank you, gentlemen, ma'am, ladies. All right.